Is an incredible story out of Germany. You've got to hear this one. A lawyer who landed an out-of-this-world job defending people who have suffered at the hands of extraterrestrials has started his very first major case. Former industrial law specialist, his name is Jens Lorik, announced last week he would defend those whose close encounters with outer space visitors left them physically and mentally shattered. Now he has his very first client, a hotel chef. His name is Paul Hoffman, a 23-year-old, claiming he was kidnapped by aliens and that he's never been the same since. Hoffman said, about 2 years ago, a cross-shaped spaceship pulled me up and took me out into space. When I came around, it was daylight again. He says he does not remember what they look like, but only that he had been manipulated and was sent back to Earth as some kind of apprentice shaman. He said, I was supposed to bless the city for the arrival of further aliens. Now, the chef closed his bank account, squatted in an empty property in Dresden, and bathed nude, as ordered by the aliens, he says, in a municipal fountain. When police caught him naked on a bike, he was sent to a psychiatric ward of a local hospital. Now, the attorney thinks that police acted wrongly, and they're demanding the client's release. He has brought a lawsuit against the city in which he places the blame for his client's behavior on things unknown. And he says there are no legal grounds to put somebody in a psychiatric hospital because he may have been the victim of extraterrestrials. Isn't that an incredible story? Well, in a moment, we're going to talk with something even more serious, of course, the Roswell case with Stanton Friedman and Jesse Marcel Jr. on Coast to Coast AM. And two guests for you, Stanton Friedman, of course. I'll introduce him in a second. He can stay with us as long as he wants. Jesse Marcel Jr. joined the U.S. Navy in 1962. He was assigned to the USS Renville and shortly thereafter participated in the Cuban Missile Crisis, attached to combat units as a member of the ship's company. The Renville then sailed for Westpac and then on to the Southeast Pacific area, where he participated in combat training in case of enemy attacks on the ship. After the Westpac tour, he completed specialty training, and here I go with this one. It's otolaryngology, I guess. That's the study of nose, ears, the throat, in any kinds of disorders and diseases. At the Naval Hospital in San Diego, California, that's where he specialized in that. Jesse retired from the Navy in 1971, entered private practice in Montana. He joined the Montana Army National Guard in 1973, went through helicopter training as a flight surgeon at Fort Rucker, Alabama, earning his wings in 81. During his career in the National Guard, he was also appointed the state surgeon of the state of Montana. Jesse is the son of the late Jesse Marcel, who was the first military officer at the 1947 crash site. And tonight he will tell his father's story and his own, the Roswell legacy. Let's introduce, first of all, Jesse Marcel Jr. Dr. Marcel, how are you?
Very good, George. How are you doing tonight?
Good. And how did I get your specialty? Was I close?
That was close enough. You know, close enough for government work.
Okay. And let me introduce, of course, the father of modern-day ufology, Stanton Friedman. You all know him. He's been on the program before. He is an expert in investigating UFO cases. His websites are linked up right now at coasttocoastam.com. He's been a physicist. He has been all over the place working for Fortune 500 companies. And he's considered also the father of Roswell. He was the first to investigate the incident in 1978. Stanton Friedman back with us. Hey, Stan, how are you?
Well, it's early in the morning, 3 o'clock here, but I'm fine.
I always do that,
too. I've got a new story for you, George. This is the cheap conspiracy story.
Okay.
This came over the wires, the CIA to air decades of its dirty laundry next week, which just happens to be when Roswell stuff will be starting.
Interesting.
A Washington Post article. It's a long article, and you'll be hearing all about all the dirty laundry from the CIA, all the bad things they did back in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Bound to try to drown out Roswell, I think. Right, Jess? They're taking away our airtime.
I think so. No question about that.
Well, I'm going to be live in Roswell on July 6th, and you two, I trust, will be there, right?
I'm looking forward to it.
With bells on, with bells on.
Okay, great. You're invited to come by the program when I'm on. One of the reasons we've got Stan tonight, of course, is he has written the foreword to the book, The Roswell Legacy. But just as important, Stan was the reason why that this whole story came out. Stan, you got to tell us this incredible story about how when you were, I believe you were where, in Louisiana? At a television, yeah, you were in a TV station studio promoting one of your college speeches. That's where I met you in 1971, as a matter of fact, in Detroit. You were there, and you found out about this case. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it was really crazy. I was supposed to do three interviews at the station, and the first two interviews went off quickly, and then the third reporter was nowhere to be found, and they didn't have cell phones back then. So the station manager is giving me coffee. He's looking at his watch. He's embarrassed. He knew the person that brought me to the station, and he knew I had other things to do. And out of the blue, out of his embarrassment, I guess, he suddenly says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. And great investigator that I am, I said, who's he? And his line just knocked me over. He said, well, he handled wreckage of a crash flying saucer when he was in the military. What? You know, well, tell me more about him. Well, he lives over in Houma. He's a great guy. We're old ham radio buddies. You ought to talk to him. And you know, the reporter showed up, so there was like a 20-minute window of opportunity there. The next morning, after a great crowd at LSU, I called information from the airport in Baton Rouge and got a number for Jesse and called him and talked to him. He told me his story, but he didn't have a precise date. And he was the intelligence officer at the base in Roswell. And, you know, I knew there were loads of sightings in the summer of 47. Well, a few months later, I was in Bemidji, Minnesota, and somebody approached me about, did you ever hear anything about a crash saucer in New Mexico? Well, yes, I have. I got information, shared it the very next day with Bill Moore, who lived in Minnesota at that time. And Bill had a third story from an article in the Flying Saucer Review, an English publication, about an English actor named Huey Green who, when driving across the country from L.A. to Philadelphia, heard on the radio about a crashed saucer in New Mexico. His son lived in Canada. Bill was able to dig out a date from him, like early July 1947. Bill went to the University of Minnesota Library Periodicals Department, started looking. There was the story, verifying what Jesse had told me and giving us the names of other people who were involved. And that began a two-year quest. We talked to 62 people. This is before the internet, so we found people the hard way. Before the first book came out, The Roswell Incident, Bill and I did over 90% of the research, and the book was written by Charles Berlitz with Bill. And over the next five years, we located another group of people, was totaling up to 92. And we published papers at the MUFON network, and I'll be giving one about Roswell at this year's MUFON conference in August. It's on my website, www.stantonfriedman.com. And that led to the NBC program. I instigated that, the one about Roswell.
Right.
They did Unsolved Mysteries. And would you believe there were people who called into that program? Who had heard about it from one person or another.
Sure.
That led to a flood. My own book in 92, a new issue in 97, a crash at Corona. And let me clear up something. People keep asking me, you mean Corona is different from Roswell? The crash occurred 80 miles or so from Roswell. The closest town, if you can call it that, is Corona, a small place. So we called our book, Don Berliner and I, Crash at Corona. It's the Roswell incident.
It's the Roswell incident. Okay, so at what point, let's bring Jesse in for a second. And Stan, you're more than welcome to stay with us all night if you want. I mean,
well,
you're...
Let's see if I can stay awake.
It's the invite is there. Jesse, in 1947, how old were you at that time?
I was 11 years old in 47.
Okay, so that's going to make you 70, 71 years old now, right?
Yeah, I'll be 71 at the end of August, and that's what it'll be.
I love the book, The Roswell Legacy, but what took you so long to write it?
You know, I first started writing this book when I was in Iraq. I figured that, I'm getting older, and signs of mortality are all around me, as you might imagine there. So I thought, you know, I better get this down on paper before I go, because I would really like people to realize what the story meant to me and to my family. So that's when I started writing it, and it just basically it's the effect of what Roswell has on my family and hopefully the civilizations of the world. But again, it was just because I realized that time is getting short, so I better get this thing down before it's too late.
How old was...
Better tell people what Jesse was doing in Iraq, Jess.
Sir? What's that?
He wanted to know what were you doing in Iraq?
I was a flight surgeon with an attack helicopter battalion. So I got a lot of flight hours in Black Hawk. As a matter of fact, I saw most of Iraq from the cockpit of Black Hawk, which was very interesting. Probably the safest place to be at that time.
And I assume that's during the first Gulf War, obviously.
No, that's just this one that's going on right now.
Really?
Yes.
When they called you in, Jeff?
You know, I got called. You know, I retired from the Guard in '96, and lo and behold, when the Gulf War broke out again, they called me back into the regular Army this time as a flight surgeon, and so I went over to Iraq in, I guess, October of 2004, and finally got home in November of 2005. So I spent 13 months out there.
Jesse, you're 67, 68 years old, right around then, right?
Right then, yeah. You know, I thought I was going to be the oldest guy out there, but no, there was another one. 73-year-old out there.
I can't believe that.
I thought I was going to be the top honors in there, but now they had some guys older than I out there. So
I mean, you said that you were in Iraq, I'm saying, okay, maybe he was in 91. No, I never would have anticipated this.
No, I just got home, as a matter of fact. So, as a matter of fact, my unit may be going back next year, and it's possible I might go back with them. I don't know.
Absolutely incredible. Well, good for you, and thank you for what you've done.
Very interesting tour, and I'd go back in a heartbeat.
How old was Dad when he passed on?
Let's see, he was born in 1907, and he died in 86, so I guess 79.
So he's about 79 years old.
Yes,
okay.
Huh?
All right. When you were this little 11-year-old boy, we're going to talk with you tonight in two fronts, Jesse. One's going to be Jesse Marcel Jr., the 11-year-old.
Uh-huh.
And then it's going to be Jesse Marcel Jr., the adult who's taken this Roswell legacy through these years. And Stanton, I'd want you to jump in any time because you're going to be the color commentator tonight in this program,
okay.
Right?
But well, I'm one of the few investigators that's been in the home of both Jesse Sr. and Jesse Jr.
Well, what's going to make this program so, I think, phenomenal is you, Stanton Friedman, have the nuances down about every little issue in Roswell, so nothing will be unturned tonight, and I'm glad you're with us. This is historical as far as I'm concerned. Historical for two reasons for me, Jesse. Number one, when I was a 21-year-old radio reporter in Detroit, Stan was my very first radio interview. They sent me to a college, and there he was, and I was fascinated with UFOs before I went in, and I was never the same when I came out. And in your particular case, knowing what your father did, it has been my lifelong ambition to interview you over all these years that I've been doing radio talk, which is now well over 10 years. I've wanted to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate your kind words.
You know, Stan would be on my programs 10 years ago, for example, and always talk about your father's case, and then he would start talking about you. So I'm glad you're here with both of us. But let's talk now about Jesse Marcel Jr., the 11-year-old. On the day of the crash, do you remember what your father said? I mean, did he start sharing some of this information right away, or did that take time?
Well, that took a little time. But actually, you know, what his job was to go out to the rancher, for the Foster Ranch, and pick up some of the representative parts of the debris. And as it turns out, our house was on the way back to the airbase. But this is about maybe midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning when he came back through town. And what he had done, he realized it's very special, that something that we would never see again, which is right. He wanted to show it to my mother and myself. So he had pre-positioned a lot of this debris on the kitchen floor. Then he got my mother and myself up to look at this. So we got in there and looked at this. There's this metallic debris. He said, look at this. I think he used the word flying saucer. I'm not quite sure. But he wants us to examine the debris for what it looked like. And, first of all, he said, look for any vacuum tubes or any electronic components. Of course, he already knew there wasn't, but he wanted us to be satisfied about that. So we looked around there, again, no condensers, resistors, vacuum tubes, or wires of any kind. And he said, well, look at this. Look at the foil and look at the little beams here. So I picked up the foil. I didn't try to bend it or tear it or stress it like other people did. I just, this is kind of strange-looking stuff. But I think the strange part were the beams. It had looked like symbols written along the inner surface of the column there. And I remember they at first thinking that was like Egyptian hieroglyphics, but no, it's not Egyptian hieroglyphics. And it's more like geometric symbols of some kind. But these were imprinted along the inner surface, and I do remember the distinct color. They were like a purple-violet hue, kind of reflective of the light there is in the overhead in the kitchen there.
Did your father, Jesse, ever say at that time, this is a balloon, this is a military U.S. craft, this is something Earth-made,
Heavens, man-made? This is something very unique. If it was that, he would not have taken the time to bring it by the house.
He told me in our first conversation that what was strange to him is that when he went out to the crash site, he couldn't find anything conventional. He'd been at plane crashes before. He was in a plane that got shot down. I think Jesse Jr. shares that distinction. And there wasn't anything that you'd expect from a military aircraft crash. Nothing conventional. That's important.
And what's important tonight, too, and I want everybody to understand this, we have all kinds of guests on this program. Some are entertaining. Some are very darn right scientific. We're talking with a medical-trained doctor who has no reason to make up this story on things that he saw and heard from his father, who was the first military officer on the crash. And Stanton, I think that's so important. I think Jesse may be one of the most credible witnesses we've ever had.
Oh, of course. No question about that.
Well, thank you.
So,
we need more like Jesse to come forward, and I'm sure there's still some out there, incidentally.
Yes, that's true. I guess, Jesse, your father never said that there were crash dummies at the site, right?
No, decidedly not. No dummies there. But, that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, too, is to maybe help trigger some people to come out and start talking about this. The guys, the first-handers who are still alive, come on out, test the waters, it's fine. Tell what you know. Let the people know what happened out there.
Stan, when you were talking to Jesse Marcel Sr., did he ever tell you what he thought this was?
Yeah, it was something not of this world. One of the early interviews with him that's on tape is in my movie, UFOs Are Real. We went to HOMA and filmed him in like 1978, late 78. And he explicitly stated that it was something not from this world. We didn't know what it was, but it wasn't from here. And he was, he was an intelligence officer for the only atomic bombing group in the entire world. It was his job to know what was going on. He knew about the rockets over at White Sands. He had been at plane crashes. There was nothing normal, conventional, anything like that about what he saw. So he didn't say it's from Zeta Reticuli. I mean, I say that now in my new book.
But
he certainly indicated it wasn't from Earth.
Stan, I want to get your reaction and Jesse's reaction also when we come back after the break. Earlier this week, we had Bill Burns on, the publisher of UFO Magazine. You both know him. And Bill was telling us about the Walter Haut affidavit, apparently, that he signed, testifying exactly what Jesse Marcel Sr. has said, backed up now by another military officer who was there. I mean, this is absolutely mind-boggling.
It's in a new book, Witness to Roswell.
All right, well, everyone, stay with us. This is, for me, a historical night on Coast to Coast. We'll be back with Jesse Marcel Jr., Stanton Friedman. We talk about the Roswell legacy. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. And tonight we're talking with Jesse Marcel Jr. and Stanton Friedman about the Roswell legacy. Back with them both in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Jesse, when your father brought some of the debris home for your family to look at, had that picture with General Ramey already been taken, that picture with your father that we've all have seen by now, or did that come afterwards?
That came afterwards because, again, what he was doing, he was on his way to the airbase when he went by the house and showed the debris to my mother and myself. And after we brought the material to the airbase for the base commander's Blanchard to look at this, they decided this was something very unusual. So Colonel Blanchard dispatched my dad to Fort Worth, where General Ramey is located, to show Ramey the debris. And that's where the photographs were taken, in Ramey's office. So this is afterwards.
Okay, when you looked at what was put in the paper, did those items look the same to you, or did they look like they might have been switched?
Well, you know, I didn't see the pictures immediately. It's several years later that I learned of the photographs that were taken in General Ramey's office. But I can tell you right now, that was not what was on our kitchen floor. And if you look at my dad's face, you know, when he's holding up the piece of this radar target, he's like, you got to be kidding me. You know, what is this all about? But they're trying to demonstrate that that was just a weather balloon. There is even a balloon envelope in the background there. So this is just parts of a radar target, a Rowan radar target.
Jesse, did he come home later on and say, doggone it, they're changing the story, or they've told me to say this? Anything like that?
Okay, what he did, when he came back home, and I'm not sure whether it was the next day or what time of this is, but when he came back, yeah, he sat my mother and myself down and says, look, don't ever talk about this. This is something that didn't happen. Just treat it as a non-event. And by golly, that's the way we treated it for many, many years afterwards. But so he told me not to ever talk about this. And I think I remember seeing him in an interview one time where he said he was actually became part of the cover-up himself. But I'm not sure if that's accurate or not. But anyway, he just told us, don't talk about it.
Stanton, yeah. do you believe he was frustrated as the years went by?
Well, I think he was, but I think you have to understand something here. Jesse was in the military. He fought in World War II, Jesse Sr. You follow orders, and that was standard practice.
Yes.
It would have been quite extraordinary if he hadn't followed orders. And all through this story, we have chain of command. Jesse Sr. was a major. He reported to Colonel Blanchard. Colonel Blanchard reported to General Ramey in Fort Worth, who was head of the 8th Air Force. He reported to General McMullen, who was temporary head of Strategic Air Command in Washington. Colonel DuBose, who worked for General Ramey, took the call from General McMullen telling him three things, and I got this directly from DuBose. Blanchard was dead, and McMullen was dead, and Ramey was dead, but DuBose was alive. I located him. And he was told, send some of that wreckage up here today with one of your colonel couriers. I want you to get the press off our back. I don't care how you do it. And I don't want you ever to talk about it again, not even with your buddy Roger Ramey. That's an order. Do I need to put it in writing? No, sir. When a two-star general tells a colonel what to do, he does it. He doesn't argue about it. Colonel Marcel, who's on the program now, can tell you that, right, Jesse?
You betcha. You better believe it.
Jesse, as you were growing up in Roswell, did the story of the crash kind of filter around the people who lived there?
Well, you know, after this happened, there were a plethora of reports of strange things flying through the sky at that time. But, you know, it was summertime. I was having fun with my friends riding bicycles. And my dad told me not to talk about that, so I kind of put it in the back of my mind. Never forgetting about it, but I put it out of mind at that time.
So people were seeing UFOs or something in the skies way before the crashes.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there's a lot of newspaper accounts of strange things being seen in the sky, you know, and I guarantee they were not weather balloons.
Stanton, what would be in that area that would be of interest to extraterrestrials?
Well, I think you have to understand that New Mexico was a hotbed of advanced classified research and development. There are two nuclear weapons labs in New Mexico. The base there, Roswell, the home of the 509th, the only atomic bombing group in the world. The largest military base in the country was White Sands Missile Range, to the west of there, about 100-and-some miles. Kirtland Air Force Base was the largest single employer in the state of New Mexico. That's up in Albuquerque. There was the group, the 509th in Roswell, Cannon Air Force Base. If there was one state that you could be sure spies would be present, it would be New Mexico. That's why when Jesse went out, he was told to take a counterintelligence corps guy with him. And you knew Cabot, didn't you, Jesse?
Oh, yes. They're close friends with the family, Sheridan Cabot.
Yeah, he was counterintelligence, and he had a different chain of command than Jesse Marcel Sr. did. But there's no question that, remember, the first atomic bomb test was over at White Sands Missile Range in 1945, July 16th. Incidentally, the press was told an ammunition dump had blown up, and fortunately nobody was injured. They had plenty of experience at covering things up. So, you know, it's not surprising that visitors would be there. And, you know, consider the times. There were a lot of sightings. The first sighting that got a lot of attention, Kenneth Arnold's sighting, was up in Washington State. And Hanford Works are in Washington State, mm-hmm. where they were making plutonium. And
same year, wasn't it? Arnold was 47 also, wasn't he?
Just 2 weeks earlier, June 24th, yep. It hit the paper on June 25th. And this was less than 2 weeks after that. And there were 2,000 sightings in that period of time. July 4th weekend, hotbed of sightings all over the country. I mean, there was a little ridicule around one of the states where there weren't any sightings. 44 had sightings. One where there wasn't was Kansas, which, of course, was dry. That was what the newspaper article said.
Can we assume that the objects that Kenneth Arnold saw, Stanton, that these might have been the objects involved in the crashes?
Well, we don't know. There were nine objects. He timed their passage from in front of one mountain to in front of another, knew the distance in between. It comes out between 1,200 and 1,500 miles an hour. The speed record at the time was like 675. First supersonic flight wasn't until October that year. Arnold's thought was, hey, the atom bomb was developed in secret. These are new government military craft. Didn't make it into World War II, but they're probably ours. They certainly were different from anything he ever knew anything about, and he was an experienced pilot.
I'm at the belief now, Stanton, that there's always a mothership and that these craft come down and they do their maneuvers within our atmosphere, but they're not the ones that come here.
Well, I agree with that entirely, yeah. And I've used the analogy that we have aircraft carriers, huge monsters that don't need to be refueled for 18 years.
Mm-hmm.
This was in the Navy. He knows about them. And little small airplanes. Now, it would make sense because we have reports of huge objects in the sky, say half mile to a mile long. They're not the ones that crash or come down and land or whatever. They're way out there. But there's some excellent reports up in the Yukon, the Japan Airlines case of 20 years ago. A half a mile long? That's huge.
That's big.
But remember, the two different environments between the stars, where there's a lot of nothing. And then when you get near a planet, you got a lot of gravity, you got an atmosphere, you got to worry about heating and all kinds of things. And going the speed of light doesn't make a lot of sense around the planet. It only takes a seventh of a second to go around.
Jesse,
somebody for lunch at that velocity.
Did your father, from the moment he told you and your mother, we're not talking about this anymore? And we'll get to the deathbed, the discussions you had,
okay,
the days before he died. But in between that, did he say anything about it over the years?
Well, you know, I guess the closest thing was, you know, standing at the Supermarket checkout line. You know, you have these magazines that sensationalize UFO, or at least I was kidnapped, was brought to Venus, and this, that, and the other. And we kind of would look at each other and say, well, yeah, we know better than that, but that's basically all we talked about at that time.
I should throw in here that the man at the television station, I talked to him years later and asked what Jesse had told him about the case. And he said, look, we were ham buddies. And I asked him about it. And he said, I can't talk about that. And I mention that because I have people saying, oh, Jesse was talking all over the place, making up stories. That's malarkey. Jesse didn't tell this guy anything, but he remembered him, and those guys, ham radio buddies, have a good connection, right, Jess?
They're real buddies there.
Jesse, what about people like Walter Hout? Did you know him? He stayed in Roswell. If you did know him, what were your impressions of him?
Well, you know, Walter and his wife live right down the block from us there at 1300 West 7th Street in Roswell. And I don't know if they're that close, you know, with my folks, but I'm sure I've met Walter on many occasions back at that time. Because they just, like I say, they live right just a few doors down from us.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we asked Walter about Jesse Jr. way back, Bill Moore and I, years and years back in the 70s. And it was interesting that what he said, he was a bright young lad. That's what Walter said about Jesse.
That was
Jr. He was right.
Yeah, sure he was.
Oh, he is a bright.
Of course. But,
you know, and incidentally, Walter dropped the instrument package in one of the two nuclear weapons that were tested at Operation Crossroads in 1946 in the Pacific. And I mention that because one skeptic says, oh, he just made up the story. In the first place, the public information officer for the 509th would never make up a story without the boss's permission kind of thing. In the second place, he obviously had to be one of the best bombardiers around, or he wouldn't have been chosen for that job, because the test doesn't make any sense if you can't get instrument measurements.
Good point.
There's
now,
an awful lot of malignment of the people involved here by the nasty, noisy negativists.
Stanton, when did the debris go to Wright Patterson?
Well, the
immediately?
Jesse didn't take it to Wright Pat. He stopped in Fort Worth, Texas.
Right. Right.
We know that because of an FBI memo, that it was apparently the same day, July 8th, that a separate flight was sent up to Wright Field. Now, there's a standard technique in intelligence work, and Jesse Jr. can talk about that, where you break the chain so the guys at the beginning don't know where it winds up at the end. So Jesse Sr. didn't see the guys who got it up at Wright Field, and they didn't see the guys who brought it from Fort Worth, from Roswell to Fort Worth.
It's compartmentalization of information.
Yeah, standard practice.
What about the occupants, Jesse? Did your dad ever talk about the aliens?
You know,
we've heard so much about.
He never did discuss it with me. Although I guess he might very well. He was in a position to have seen them, but. Again, he never really discussed this finding with me.
Stanton, do we know if Jesse Marcel even saw the aliens?
He certainly never talked to me about it. It was interesting, though, that a man named Louis Rickett, and Jess, I think you knew him, too.
Yes, sure did.
He was another counterintelligence corps guy. He, in a conversation I had with him, said that there were certain things that weren't talked about, except under very special, you know, closed doors, cleared facilities, all that kind of thing. He was hinting at something like that, but he didn't flat out say anything about bodies. But it would seem they would have fallen in that class of information not to be discussed outside. But Jesse Sr. never, that first television interview and stuff, never talked about bodies as far as I know.
Where did we get the information of the occupants? How did that come about?
From the crash over at the Plains of St. Augustine and Glenn Dennis's testimony. He was a mortician in town who told about the nurse who told him that she got grabbed to help out with a dissection or an autopsy, I'm not sure which, at the base hospital. And we haven't been able to find that nurse, and Glenn is still alive, but not in good health, and I'm sure he won't be doing any interviews during the Roswell fiesta coming up, where Jesse and I will be probably doing lots of interviews. And, you know, I still haven't heard where you can get Jesse's book, because I know it's not at my bookstore here, and I'm anxious to see it. Jesse, you got copies available to the public?
Yeah, if people are interested, it's on MarcelJr.com. There's a display about the book there, or the Roswell Legacy. thebooklegacy.com. Those are the two websites that they can look at for information on the book. But I guess the best one would be marceljr.com.
Okay, we've got to get this out on Amazon, Jesse, because people will be searching for this like crazy.
That's right. Well, I think it'll be very interesting. Like I say, it's a book that explains the feelings of the family toward the Roswell event and what it's done for us.
Jesse, what did this do to your father? Did you see any kind of personality change? I mean, if you really know, firsthand that we've been visited by extraterrestrials from another land, I mean, that would have a profound effect on us. You see a change?
Well, I really wasn't around at that time because I was in the Navy and I was off at school and things like that, so I really didn't have any close personal contact with my dad during those years after that. But I do know one thing, that he must have been frustrated about something, because when we moved up here to Helena, we brought the cedar chest that had all his medals and decorations in it. When I went through that, they're all gone. So I think he must have gotten so frustrated he threw them away.
That's something.
That's too bad. But we could get them back, of course, as records, but the original medals are no longer present.
Did you, at what point did you begin to tell yourself, now, because we're going to get into your story, that something was very unusual, something happened here that was out of this world?
Well, not until after 1978, that's when my dad was starting to talk about it. And then people would come over to ask me about that, because, of course, the namesake there. So I really didn't talk very much about it before then. But since my dad died in 86, that's when I've been catching a lot of flack also, and people have really been coming to me and say, well, what really happened? What's your opinion? What do you think it was? This, that, and the other.
And we should mention here that, Jess, you were involved in military aircraft accident investigations too, weren't you?
Yeah. As a flight surgeon, you do have a course in the aircraft accident investigation, and I've seen a number of aircraft accidents at various places here. So anyway, it's not unusual for me to, at least I've seen aircraft accidents. I do know that the material seen in Roswell was not from that, though.
That's my point. You were in a position to make a judgment about that, having been at accident.
You bet.
Did they find any craft intact at all, Stan, or were they all just simply obliterated?
Well, the one over in the plains of San Augustine apparently had a big crack in the side, and it was almost intact, would be a way to put it. The bodies were outside, and the government covered that one up, too. And it wouldn't surprise me if there was a mid-air collision between the two. And I had one person say, hey, if one UFO is rare, how could you have two in the same place? And I should say that 40% of the 853 sightings reported in the UFO wave of 1947, a sort of book by a guy named Ted Blocher, 40% of the case involved more than one object seen at a time. And it's standard practice, and Jess can verify this, to send up a pilot and a wingman on missions. So if they ran into a radar beam, if they ran into a storm, whatever, in a mid-air collision, I asked a retired general who'd been a pilot and who had been base commander at Roswell in the mid-60s, General Exxon, I said, if you have a aircraft collision in the air, is the damage usually symmetric, that is the same in the two aircraft? He said, no. Usually one will make it down barely and the other one tough luck. And that's what seems to have happened here. What Jesse saw, Jesse Sr., was debris spread out over this huge area. And one of the things he told me in our first conversation is there was no crater, which means there had to be a mid-air explosion.
Yes, it blew up.
Spread stuff over three-quarters of a mile long and hundreds of yards wide.
What are the possibilities that these were two different types of ETs and maybe they shot at each other?
Wow, now you're getting into science fiction. I have no idea.
I would like to add this. one thing, the debris that I saw looked like it came from the interior of something. Because there was not any really structural material there. So this looked like it came from the inside, like it was blown through the side of the craft.
Yeah, that's interesting. An interior bulkhead or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, people have asked me, well, if this stuff is so strong and indestructible, you know, how come it was...
Save that, Stan. Save that when we come right back. We'll be back in a moment. Jesse Marcel, Jr., Stanton Friedman on Coast to Coast AM.